welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books. A
podcast with two siblings who randomly don't appear for 2 weeks and say nothing about it.
Hey, we said something the first week.
That's true. Last week, I got sick with a horrible sinus infection, and Ben and I were going to record anyway. And then our benefactor of the recorder was using it instead. So we were just like, oh, that sucks.
Damn, I guess we can just never record again.
I guess all of our 10 fans will be so disappointed.
Also, apparently neither of us is willing to invest in a recorder.
I know, I called Scott and I was like, why do you have the recorder? And he said, you could go buy one. And I was like, fuck you. You think I'm some kind of savage?
So we love books. I guess we just don't love recording.
I read a lot of books in the past 2 weeks, so I would say that's an accurate statement.
I guess we'll throw down the spoiler policy real quick.
Well, I'm Gabs.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you're Gabs, I guess I must be Ben.
Oh, what? Wait, is that short for Benjen or a Bendigo? Or Benedict?
Benjamin.
Oh, what a loser.
I know, the original lame Hebrew.
Hebrew is lame. They're bun. making all of our Jewish listeners go, people say that a lot.
Yeah, well, there's only like 2,000 years of history to back that attitude up.
I'm not really anti-Semitic, guys. Don't even worry about it. So this week we're reading To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee.
The great American classic of classicness and classitude.
It's very, very true. Fun fact, To Kill a Mockingbird is a book that everyone has at least heard of or seen the movie, and it's the only book that Harper Lee ever wrote.
Yeah, I actually didn't know that until fairly recently. I found that shocking.
Yeah, you could finish it and be like, oh, cool, I'm gonna read more stuff that she wrote, because, you know, this book is really good, and then you go to check it out and you're like, oh, there's nothing else.
Yeah, if you want to read more stuff she wrote, you'd have to go rummage through her dresser drawer and steal her diary.
Which would be pretty impressive considering that I think she's dead now.
Plus, you know, when you read someone's diary, it just creates all this drama. It's not even worth it.
It needs so much editing anyway. So even though everyone should know about this book, we will just go ahead and say we do have a spoiler policy for the books that we talk about.
Yep, and that policy is we spoil everything. So, like, if you hate that, then leave!
Yeah, but if you don't know that Tom Robinson is convicted and killed and that Boo Radley appears at the end, then you're just an idiot.
Apparently, if you've only seen the movie, you might not know some of those things.
If you've only seen the movie, read the book. It does not take that long, seriously.
Yeah. And if you've only read the book, watch the movie.
I saw part of the movie.
I actually haven't seen the movie either, but it's one of those where the movie is arguably as significant in its genre as the book is in its genre.
Yeah, and I do happen to think Gregory Peck is a fine specimen of man, so that does help. Before we get started, we did want to bring up listener response, just because, you know, we had some.
I know. I was so happy.
So first, I just wanted to give a shout-out to my buddy Anthony / Mad Dog for referencing us on Facebook. I didn't even know you listened to the podcast, so yay, thanks.
Yeah, so thanks, buddy. And we also got a comment on The Fault in Our Stars from the Queen of Quirky, which is a good screen name.
Yeah, probably not her real name.
Probably not. I'm 99% certain I know who this person actually is, but we'll stick with screen names for now. And she had an idea on why Hazel was so obsessed. What happened to those characters in an American, oh boy, words, imperial, fuck.
Wow, an imperial affliction.
Affliction, I keep wanting to say ambition, I'm pretty sure it's a Noam Chomsky book, though. So anyway, why she was obsessed with the characters, because perhaps they were parallel, or at least in Hazel's mind, parallel to her and her own family, and that she's concerned about what happened to her characters after she dies. I thought that was very interesting, and yeah, probably right.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not just Hazel so obsessed with the book, she has to know what happens to the characters, but in some way she's concerned with, you know, the characters in her own life and how they're going to carry on after she is gone. And she does get some of that closure at the end when her mom tells her she's going to be a counselor, so.
It makes that scene and, like, the emotional impact of it make a lot more sense to me, too, like, logically speaking.
I mean,
it made sense anyway, but then with the idea that, oh, this is what happens with Mom and the Dutch Tulip Man.
Yeah, exactly. It's a nice idea, and a good one, so thanks for that. And then we also just wanted to give a quick shout-out to Edgar, who mentioned that he listens to the podcast and is apparently from Brazil.
At least according to WordPress.
Yeah, which, awesome. And he asked if we were going to consider doing Looking for Alaska, which is the, I think right now at least, the more popular of the books that John Green has written, and we are going to add it to our suggestions page, so.
Yes, probably won't do it right away.
Yeah.
But we're both planning to read it, for sure.
Yeah.
Because we both love that book, and we'll get around to it. We don't want to do too many author repeats too close, but it's definitely something we'd be interested in recording someday.
Mm-hmm. With that said, we'll move on to To Kill a Mockingbird.
TKM!
TKM is what we were abbreviating to each other in text messages.
Yes.
I did just want to start out with a couple of quick tidbits about Harper Lee that I find kind of interesting. She was, like, best friends with Truman Capote. For those of you who don't know, Truman Capote wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's.
What's that?
And In Cold Blood.
What's that?
Which are actually kind of opposite subject matter.
Yeah, they're not that close together.
It's like romantic comedy and murder.
Romantic murder comedy?
No. But Dill in the book, which we'll get around to talking about him, a lot of people think that Dill is actually based on Truman Capote because they didn't know each other when they were kids, and Dill is kind of, you know, flamboyant and over the top, and so is Truman Capote. And I know I already mentioned that this was the only book she ever wrote, but because of her friendship with a really good author, there are a number of people who think that Truman Capote actually wrote this book. To which I say, sucks to your ass, Mar. Because...
sucks to your ass,
Mar. I'm not, like, a Capote expert, but from what I've seen and read, he was, you know, a big enough ham and self-centered enough that he would never be able to keep that a secret. He'd be, like, running around telling everyone, oh, no, I actually wrote that. There's no way he wouldn't do that.
Not to mention, these are people who lived recently.
Yeah, like in the 50s.
And we actually have direct primary evidence of a lot of their lives and could put together probably a pretty strong oral history of their entire lives just by going and doing some interviews. I'm going to go ahead and say that this authorship question, if you think that Truman Capote wrote this book, you're even crazier than the people who think Shakespeare didn't write his plays. And I am on record as saying that they're crazy. So if you're one of those people, keep on listening, you good old crazy fan.
Yeah, and please explain to me, like, why you think that. I mean, it is strange, granted, that Harper Lee never wrote another book.
It's really strange, especially because it's not like this book was not well-received.
Yeah, it was written in pretty much an instant classic. The movie came out
the next year,
yeah,
won Best Picture.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a sensation, for sure. I don't know, maybe she just had nothing else.
Did she make a bundle of cash in, like, 2 years and go, all right, I'm going to go Boo Radley myself away in some house somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know. But, I mean, she seems kind of scout-ish. I don't know. I was telling Ben that Margaret Mitchell, who wrote To Gone with To Gone with the Wind, wow.
To Gone with...
To Gone with the
with
Wind.
With to Wind.
Jesus. That was the only book she ever wrote, which was also very popular, but she actually died in a car crash while she was writing her second book. So that's why we only have one book from her, which is like a very reasonable explanation.
Right.
And so, yeah, but Harper Lee was around for a while, so we don't really know, but we're not the Mysteries Podcast, so we should probably keep going.
Next week on the Mysteries Podcast.
Why did Harper Lee never write another book?
And the following week, Ben and Gabs go to the Pacific Ocean and search for Amelia Earhart.
Aw, yeah.
Aw, yeah.
I actually have some pretty interesting... Uh-oh. But we won't talk about that.
Yeah, not until the conspiracy podcast.
Go to Stuff You Missed in History class and listen to their Amelia Earhart update, and then we'll have a chat.
All right.
So, To Kill a Mockingbird... by Harper Lee.
Oh, is that what we're doing?
Yes. So, genre, Ben called it the
great American novel.
Yeah, there's always that joke of, you know, everyone's gonna go write the great American novel.
Right.
But this book is actually probably the closest thing we have to a great American novel.
If you had to pick one, this would, I'd say, definitely make the five finalists.
Yeah, it captures a lot of the sentiment going on, you know, of American freedom and, like, the small town feel and racism, which is unfortunately deeply, deeply ingrained in American history.
Yep.
And all of that stuff kind of wrapped up.
John Kingdon calls racism one of the four tenets of American government and character.
Yeah.
And then he was too big of a coward, dude. Write a lot about it in his book. He's just like, racism, three words, next chapter. I was like, boo.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What a loser.
I know. It's like, way to ignore one quarter of your thesis.
Just judging people, I don't know. But yeah, it's all really kind of tied up into American culture, and I think speaks a lot to people, which is one of the reasons we still read it in classrooms today. And is actually one of the books most people read in the classroom and then actually like.
Yeah, which is so frickin' rare.
Yeah.
May is part of why Faulkner was disappointing, too. It's like, oh, this other Southern American novel was amazing. And then Light in August was horrific.
Ben's gonna be forever traumatized by William Faulkner.
That's true.
The other... like, the real genre for this book, because great American novel's not a genre.
It should be.
Is coming-of-age story, or, as Ben learned today, a Bildungsroman, which is just about people learning life lessons and growing up, which is obviously Scout's entire journey throughout the book.
Yes. It's also the word you can use to describe the places where we live.
Yes, Bildungsroman. Exactly. Wikipedia also called it a Southern Gothic, but I actually don't agree with that at all.
I don't understand what the Gothic part would be, personally.
Yeah, would I feel like they just called it Southern Gothic because it's set in the South.
Right. Is it maybe, like, supposed to be the mystery of Boo Radley in the first half?
Yeah, and... the ghost thing, I guess, is kind of in there, but...
But the Gothic elements of that, it's, like, it's totally more of a... These are kids being kids.
Yeah.
Then, here's this weird story architecture and this creepy, and these creepy buildings and these unexplained things. And, like, it's not the weirdness and the creepiness of it.
Yeah, the kids are like, Boo Radley's a ghost. And their dad's like, stop bothering that right, man.
Stop bothering that poor man.
Leave him alone.
He's trying to keep to himself and you just keep, like, banging on his house and...
Fucking kids.
Damn it.
His brother's gonna shoot your face off.
That's right.
Yeah, if you want to read Southern Gothic, go read A Rose for Emily and then come back to me.
There you go.
Again, sending you off. Go do your...
go do your homework.
Ben, do you want to deliver the plot synopsis?
Yeah. Her plot synopsis was racism, boo... And by boo, I mean yay! In this case, boo clearly being boo
the character
Radley.
And not
right.
Yay for racism.
And not yay for racism, exactly.
See that play on words?
See what I did there?
If you saw it written out, it'd be way funnier.
That's
guys.
True. It works better that way. You see what I did there?
Ben and I are so hip on the audio entertainment that we only make jokes that look good written down.
That's right. I actually made a series of charts and diagrams that are hilarious about the book this week, and I'm going to be showing them to the microphone the whole time.
Just, like, pointing. 13% on this pie chart, reads.
As you can see here, I've diagrammed out all the character relationships.
The ratio of Mrs. DeBow's racism to her morphine addiction. The Novel Ideas Podcast. Where everything looks good on paper. So the setting, I believe, I actually didn't bother to look up, but I'm assuming fictional Macomb, Alabama. I kind of assumed Macomb was, like, generic southern town and not, like, an actual southern town.
I also forgot to look that up.
But they're kind of pulling a Gabriel Garcia Marquez and doing, like, a, here's a city that could be anywhere in South America kind of thing.
Yeah, it could have just been named any town, Alabama, and I would have been on board.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah. I dig it. So, yeah, we don't actually know whether or not Macomb is real, but they're in Alabama, which is hopefully geography enough for you. Apparently there was a map on the news the other day that had Mississippi and Alabama in the wrong places, oops. But we'll ignore that for now.
Oops.
It's by Florida, guys. Just keep that in mind.
Just so you know.
And the point of view, tense is actually pretty interesting because it is first person from Scout's point of view, but it's not Scout as a kid, even though she's talking about her childhood.
Right. It's written just here and there you get clues, but it seems as though it's written from the standpoint of an adult Scout.
Yeah, reflecting on that couple of years and her childhood.
Come across events and she'll go, I didn't understand this at the time, but...
Yeah, which is actually a good decision because Adult Scout is able to put together a much more coherent picture, I'm sure, than a Kid Scout.
Oh, yeah. Well, Kid Scout is hilarious, but not necessarily the most cogent and effective narrator.
Kid Scout would be like, I just beat the crap out of Walter Cunningham. I'm eating lunch now. You're like, what's happening?
I like food. I'm a kid. I want to go play.
Damn it, Scout.
Yeah, right. Try to focus. You're narrating this story.
She is, I guess we can't call her the original tomboy, but she's kind of the original tomboy. Like, running around in her overalls. That was one of the details I really liked.
Yeah, never wears dresses or skirts, which annoys the hell out of all of the women.
I loved how her Aunt Alexandra was like, stop wearing overalls! And then at the end of the book, when she's all distracted because Jem is hurt, she hands Scout a pair of overalls, and Scout's like, oh my god! Like, she handed me overalls! I thought that was really funny. And also, kind of like we talked about with Arya, everyone loves the tomboy.
Yeah.
And the fact that Scout's refusing to wear dresses just kind of makes her more likable.
I'm convinced that everybody always loves the tomboy character. We're going to have to find a book with an annoying tomboy
character.
They, like,
everyone hates.
Right?
Guys, send us suggestions on books with tomboy characters you don't like.
Yeah, if there's one out there.
If they even exist. Because I don't believe it.
Well, the thing is, a tomboy character is usually supposed to be, like, kind of the quirky, lovable character. The tomboyness is just part of that. Because we're kind of, I don't know, maybe we're getting to a point where we're oversaturated on those kinds of characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think tomboys are typically, like, it's an easy way for an author to be like, here's a character that doesn't really fit in and is trying to be themselves to other people's chagrin. And so you automatically have, like, this sympathy built in, you know, of like, oh, here's someone who doesn't fit in because they don't want to be girly. And a lot of girls understand not wanting to be girly, and so they'll be like, oh, yeah, on board. And then guys are like, I like her because she's more like a boy now.
In that exact tone of voice. I think that I actually wonder if tomboys, at least as outcast type characters, are getting more rare in real life now because, like, almost all girls wear pants all the time.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah.
And, like, wanting to go wrestle around and play in the dirt. I think all little girls actually like that stuff.
Yeah, it's fun stuff.
Like, that's what kids like to do. It's not a boy-girl thing.
I grew up with three brothers and was a pretty big tomboy, and, like, you know, my mom couldn't convince me to wear a pink until I hit, like, 14. And I had, like, a little short, like, bob boy haircut. Kind of like Scout sounds, actually. And I was never, like, teased for that, ever.
Yeah, exactly. No one
was like, Gabs, you're like a boy.
And for that matter, as an adult, there are plenty of things about you that are as girly girl as any girl.
It's true. Except for my acerbic wit.
Your acerbic
wit. Which transcends gender roles. Thank yes, you very same. Much.
I don't know any dudes who can do that either.
So, yeah. So, Scouts are a protagonist.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I guess that's not clear.
I guess, yeah, we're still... Well, okay, I wouldn't accept as a joke argue that anyone else is the protagonist, I guess. Boo Radley is the protagonist?
No.
No.
I mean, like, to a degree, I mean, and because the protagonist, you know, always has to, like, change and grow somehow.
Right.
And Scout definitely does. But Jem also does. Mm-hmm. And I think Atticus even does to a degree. But I don't necessarily think that means they're the protagonists. I think it just kind of means that it's good writing where multiple characters grow.
Yeah, and, well, gosh, it's her only novel.
Yeah.
Presumably her first novel.
Yeah, presumably. I mean, the first one that ever got published, at least.
It just seems like one of those things where if it wasn't, if, like, she had a stack of never-published novels somewhere, like, surely one of those would have been published after she died.
Yeah.
Just because this book was such a big deal. Some publisher, somewhere,
mm-hmm.
would be like, yep, printing that.
Don't care if it's any good or not. They printed the half-written sequel to Cold Sassy Tree with the author notes at the end after that person died. So,
whew.
And you didn't even like that book.
I didn't even like the first one, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Or you say Heinlein's last novel, which was still in rough draft form and published after he died, is a piece of shit. It's so bad. Like, clearly had many dozens of hours of editing left to be done in it.
Yeah. Which is the unfortunate thing. David Foster Wallace, I believe, his posthumous book got published, and people were saying, like, you can see, like, his brilliance in there because he was a really good author, but he didn't get a chance to edit it all down because he died, and, you know, even the best writers need editors to make their stuff better.
Well, right. I mean, I'm sure that lots of writers throw words against the wall sometimes and come back. They're like, I know I'm going to come back later and chop the hell out of this.
Yeah. I would be interested in learning more about that whole thing with Harper Lee.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Well, I guess, the book opens, kicks off. This is less remarkable as a starting point for discussing the book and more just like, hey, she decided to use this technique of starting at the end.
Yeah, the bookend method of...
Mm-hmm.
Well, my brother was 14, I can't even remember what age he was.
13, 14, when he broke his arm.
He broke his arm. And it's like, okay, now I'm going to like go back to the beginning, and at the end you'll learn how he broke his arm. And throughout the book you're not like, oh my god, how did Jem break his arm?
Yeah, it's not even, you know, there are a lot of, well, okay, for example, Battlestar Galactica was kind of infamous for using that storytelling technique. They'd open the episode with utter chaos, then be like, 20 hours earlier.
Oh, Aaron Sorkin loves doing that too, yeah. In West Wing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not even that where it's, drama! How do we get there? This is just, he broke his arm. You're like, okay. And then by the time he breaks his arm, like, the arm breaking's not even that significant.
I know, you're just like, oh, yeah, he did that, okay. Whatever. I think it's just kind of a symbolic, like, point Because that's, like, where a bunch of, shit happened to them.
Yeah.
And now, like, after it, they're smarter and more grown up. And it doesn't really have anything to do with the arm actually breaking.
Right.
So.
Like, maybe one of the kids, hey, how come Uncle Jem's arm, how come his one arm is kind of, like, doesn't straighten all the way or something?
Yeah.
Oh, well, let me tell you this story.
Yeah, when he was 13, he broke his arm. Like, How I Met Your
Mother. I was totally going to say that.
Kids sitting on the couch like, buh.
Why do you keep talking, Dad?
Or in this case, Mom.
Mom.
Because it's Scout.
Scout.
They call their mom Scout. Well, I guess Scout and Jem called their dad Atticus.
That's true.
They don't call him Dad. Which, does that make him even more badass?
I don't know.
I think it's just because Harper Lee came up with the name Atticus, and she was like, this name is so cool. I gotta use it as much as possible. Right.
It needs to appear at least once every other page.
So they're just gonna call their dad Atticus.
I feel like that was a decision those kids made.
That they were just like, we're just gonna call him Atticus.
Right. Like, they heard the name one day, and they're like, Dad's name is Atticus?
Yeah.
And they just started calling him that.
I believe that.
He doesn't seem like the type of guy who'd be like, call me Atticus.
No, and he wouldn't be like, you must call me Dad or Sir.
Exactly.
I mean, they do call him Sir, but again, I don't think he demands that. I think his kids just respect the hell out of him and yeah. call him Sir. Because why wouldn't you respect the hell out of him?
If Atticus Finch was your dad, you would respect the hell out
of him. I would respect the living hell out of him. I'd be kind of sad that I didn't have my dad, but...
Yeah, well.
Atticus, in my opinion, is one of the most badass literary dads of all time. I have a huge crush on him.
He is a great character. Let's talk about him a little bit more then. So, what makes him so awesome? Well, first of all, super smart.
Yeah.
Second of all, like, amazing moral compass.
Mm-hmm.
Just, like, kind of his attitude towards things, because he's in this small southern town, and on one hand, like, he doesn't seem like he should fit at all with the type of culture he's living in, but on the other hand, like, he fits perfectly.
Yeah. It is kind of a weird
juxtaposition. Anytime someone does something that doesn't, like, says something nasty, doesn't necessarily fit with his worldview, he'll always say, oh, well, that's just how they are.
Yeah.
And
the people love him. They elect him to office.
Right.
Apparently.
He's their state legislator. The way he treats people, talking about how the Cunninghams kind of pay him in kind because they don't have cash.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Yeah, that was actually one of the things I really liked about Atticus, is I think he just fundamentally respects people.
Yes.
And at the trial, when he's questioning Mayella, and she thinks that he's making fun of her by calling her Miss Mayella and
right.
Miss Ewell and stuff, and the judge says, let it be known that that's just the way Atticus talks to people. Like, he just treats them with respect from the get-go, which is probably why everyone likes him.
Right, yeah, because even though, it helps that he's a local boy, too.
Yeah.
Because the Finch family kind of was one of the first families in the area, which is a big status symbol in this town, actually.
Yeah.
But, with his political views, he could almost be a damn Yankee.
Uh-huh. So that's the other thing is, he's, in the South in the 30s, very racist. And he's not racist.
Yeah, not even a little bit, actually.
Yeah, he really respects the African-American community and, isn't eager to take this trial on because he knows it's just going to end with a loss anyway, but he still tries as hard as he can and, probably the only person in town who could get away with doing that without... he almost gets the shit kicked out of him for it anyway.
Yep.
But...
Well, and during that trial period, or the leading up to it, a couple of the adults talking to his children, one of them said, he is the man that this town relies on to do the right thing when they can't do it themselves.
Yeah, I think their neighbor said that.
Miss Maddie said that. Yeah, or he. Let's see. well, just, like, some of the things he says kind of have that, like, almost that, they're almost like epigrams.
Yeah.
The, kind of the Salver Hardin thing, a little bit, except Atticus is better at it. But, like, when he says you always, when you answer a child's question, you always have to tell them the truth. Like, yeah. It just, this is one of those sentences that sounds like capital W wisdom.
Yeah. Like, even if they don't understand it, like, you can't lie to them.
Mm-hmm.
He says, oh, gosh, crap, I just forgot the other thing. No. Oh, like, when, like, people are all concerned about Scout running around, you know, he's like, whatever. He lets the kids do their thing, like, with his guidance.
Right, yeah.
And expects them to do the right thing because of the way he's talked to them about stuff.
Right, and he doesn't give commands. He doesn't, like, hand them down from on high like a lot of the fathers in that community clearly do. Parents, I should say,
mm-hmm.
in that community clearly do. He always has a conversation about it. So he doesn't say, don't go and do this thing. Don't go and bother Boo Radley. He'll say, you shouldn't bother Boo Radley, and here's why.
Yeah.
Like, he's trying to live his life. You shouldn't go bother him while he's trying to do that. Like, it's not nice. You should be nice.
I mean, as Ben and I noted, I think before we started, like, his kids do everything he asks them not to do, like, anyway.
Yep.
Don't, please don't come to the courthouse today. Then they're immediately like, let's go to the courthouse.
Damn it.
But then, like, once they are there, he's like, well, they know about it anyway, so.
I also just really enjoyed the way that he spoke.
Yeah.
Like, the way things get phrased. The words he uses, like, he's using law school language to speak to his 9-year-old tomboy daughter.
Right. Well, I love that Scout learned how to read when she was, like, 4, because she just crawls into his lap and reads whatever he's reading.
Right.
He, like, never taught her. She just learned it. And then one of the scenes I really liked with Atticus, you know, because she was talking about how he's kind of the older dad, and so, like, he doesn't go play catch with Jem or any of that stuff, and so there's a tendency to kind of maybe be embarrassed of him because he's not, like, the cool, strong dad. And then in that scene where he shoots the rabid dog from, like, 50 yards off or whatever, like, gets it right in the head.
Yeah.
And the sheriff is like, oh, yeah, your dad's, like, the crack shot of Maycomb County. And they're like, what?
Huh?
And then...
Because he, like, won't even... He doesn't even want guns in the house.
Yeah, he, like, won't even hold a gun. And Scout's like, I'm gonna go tell everyone. And he's like, I don't want anybody to know that. What the hell?
Like, oh, man.
Come on.
You could be the cool dad.
But he has that very, like, peaceful streak running through him.
Yeah, and he's also the guy who has the line that the title of the book comes from.
Right. You never...
Never kill a
mockingbird. Never kill a mockingbird.
All right, you have your uncle got you these little air rifles. I know you're going to go shoot stuff. Don't shoot any mockingbirds. And we'll talk about that a lot more later.
Yeah.
So let's hit a couple of the other characters here.
No.
Just
want to talk about Atticus Finch for an hour.
The Atticus Finch podcast.
Actually, the one last thing I did want to say about him is, underline it all, he really, really loves his kids. Which,
yes.
Of course, makes any parent character that much better.
Yeah. I mean, you would think it'd be assumed, but, you know.
Not
but
in literature.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And then there are, you know, in contrast, like, Bob Yule, right?
Who's a terrible father.
Who's just an abusive piece of crap.
Yeah. So the Yules, one of the things about this book is it's very character-driven. There are a lot of characters and distinctive characters. And it's, like, Southern families politics stuff is in there. And so it's not just, you know, here are all these characters. It's like, here are the Finches. And here's, like, what's expected of the Finches and what they belong to. And here's the Cunninghams and how the Cunninghams operate. And then here's the Yules and how the Yules operate.
Well, how come, you know, how come he's acting that way? Because he's a Cunningham.
Yeah, like, they don't take anything from anybody. Or, you know, the Yules just show up on the first day of school and then don't come back for the rest of the year. That's just how they operate. And so one of the Yules' thing is they're poor and they're really mean and they're just kind of trashy.
Well, yeah, they're like, they're the trashy poor, whereas the Cunninghams are...
like, dignified
like your poor. Yeah, that is kind of a trope, actually.
Yeah.
Like, the we're poor, but we still have our dignity and our pride.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, like, the Cunninghams will pay in kind when they need legal help from Atticus. The Yules live near the junkyard and apparently salvage, like, all of their furniture and a good portion of their food out of stuff and that gets thrown away.
Yeah.
And have been on county assistance forever.
Yeah, I think Scout said that Bob Yule's the only man who ever got fired from the WPA for being too lazy.
Right.
During the Depression.
Like, right.
Someone got fired. And I mean, you could potentially read that as, like, some kind of class, like, conflict thing and get pissy about it. But, you know, you feel less bad when you learn that Bob is just a horrible piece of trash.
Well, yeah, he's abusive, and he's a criminal.
Yeah.
I mean, is what he is. He's, you know, like, part of the reason that Maella thought that Atticus was making fun of her when he was showing her some respect, she'd probably never, ever been shown respect before, unless, I'm gonna guess, sarcastically sometimes.
Yeah, she said, you know, he's calling me Miss, no one calls me Miss, and then he asked if she had any friends, and she thought that was an insult. And Scout even has the realization, like, if you think someone's making fun of you and they ask you about your friends, then you must be really lonely.
Like, you're a 19-year-old girl, you're supposed to have friends.
Yeah.
So...
it's not a joke. Yeah.
It's not a joke. That's a tragedy, is what that is.
And she can't have any friends because of her father.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I found deeply creepy about the whole trial scene was... in Tom Robinson's testimony, when he said that Maella kissed him and said, "I never kissed an adult man aside from my pa."
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, God.
That's no good.
Yeah. That's just, and he doesn't have his wife's dead, and that just opens up, like, a whole new creepy-ass can of worms.
Yeah.
So, basically, he's just a despicable human being.
Yeah, and then after the trial where he was basically made to look like a fool, he's going around kind of looking to get his revenge upon the people he sees as being responsible. Which is why he attacks Jem and Scout.
Yeah.
And Jem gets his arm broken.
Yeah. But more on that later.
More on that later.
Well, I guess Jem...
yeah.
He's also part of the core Finch family.
The Finches. Jem is... well, he actually, at the beginning of the book, he's not so much a moody teenager.
Yeah.
But he gets moodier as it goes along.
He definitely does.
Gets that whole teenage pubescent thing going on. And Scout's like, "But we used to be buddies. Why are you a whiny jerk?"
Yeah, why are you grouchy and don't like me anymore? And he's like, "Shut up, 10-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, "Don't hang out with me at school." And she's like, "But I thought we were buddies." It'll understand.
I mean, Jem kind of also has the unfortunate luck to have the whole trial scene happen and just, like, ramp up his teenage angst.
Right.
Because he's like, "Who am I? What's going on? Everyone's making fun of my dad. Wait, what's right and wrong? I don't understand."
Yeah.
And the trial scene, like, deeply upsets him.
Yeah, you know, So after the trial scene, that was Jem's probably biggest moment in the book. I actually see Jem's character a lot as being, like one more thing to illuminate Atticus's character almost. Because Jem is, like, when he's not being moody, when he's actually making a moral decision, or some of the times when he's talking to Scout, like, if he's not snapping at her and he's trying to explain how the world works, a lot of those times, like, he's actually saying really smart things that he's clearly learned by being a couple years older and from his father, and just, like, the fact that he's such a good kid, even though he is angsty, like, he's not the angsty pain-in-the-ass character, he's the angsty because he's 13 character.
Yeah. And not, like, in an obnoxious way.
Right. And then he's just so heartbroken at the end of the trial, at the injustice of the world. He was so... that man is so obviously innocent.
Yeah.
And they found him guilty anyway. Like, how can this happen?
I know, because, like, when the jury walked out and his dad said... Atticus says, "Well, I don't know if it'll take very long." So they might have already decided by the time you're done with dinner. And Jem says, oh, do you think they're going to acquit him that fast? And Atticus is like, oh.
He's like, oh, sorry, son, that's probably not going
to
happen.
Yeah, I mean, that also speaks to the fact that Jem and Scout don't even really realize that racism is a thing at this point.
Right. Yeah, they've seen some of it leading up to the trial, but they don't really understand what it is, because it never occurred to them.
Well, yeah, like, there's one scene, actually, where Scout says the N-word to her dad, and, like, she's asking him, like, what does this mean? Because he's never used it to them before.
Right.
And then he tells her, well, I actually thought his response was funny. He says, don't use that word, Scout, it's common. Yeah. And I was like... That sounds really funny.
It's like something our grandmother would say,
actually. Yeah. But they haven't been raised with this, like, disdain of the black community. And, you know, Calpurnia, their maid, is, like, such a, like, loved part of their family. Like, they don't understand all, the, like, the hatred boiling around the whole situation.
Yeah, their cook housekeeper is... almost surrogate mother in a lot of ways. And it sounds like Atticus actually gives her a pretty free hand to dispense at least the low and middle justice.
Yeah.
As I've heard it described before.
And I think he pays her pretty well. And I mean, if you have to live in Alabama and you have to be a maid in the 1930s, you'd want to be Atticus Finch's maid. Just saying.
It's true. As you get respected as a human being and not just expected to be part of the furniture.
Yeah.
And to, again, to be allowed to, or not just be allowed to, but, like, be respected enough as a person that you can have a hand in raising the children and not ever have that be an issue.
Yeah, you don't get scolded for, you know, oh, you... swatted my kid.
I'm sure there were houses where if the kid wanted something from the black housekeeper, the kid got it no matter what.
Yeah.
This house is not one of them.
No.
Like, you can't have that. Wrap him across the knuckles with the wooden spoon. Ow!
Get out of here!
Get out of my kitchen! Okay.
You little punk. Yeah, or I liked, I didn't like that Scout was getting berated for knowing how to read. I was like, what a fucking horrible teacher. Like, hey, stop learning, you jackass.
Well, it was, but, you know, there have been a lot of, I don't want to put a number to it, but every few years, like, there'll be new ideas in education that become these little fads. And I think probably in the 1930s was probably when teachers were... when it was becoming common for teachers to actually be college educated as teachers.
Yeah.
Because definitely the teacher they were describing was very young.
Yes.
And just like this, it sounded like a 22-year-old woman, like, straight out of her undergraduate degree and really had no idea how to deal with actual kids in an actual classroom, which, by the way, is still one of the problems with education degrees. But just, like, she was trying to go by these ideas she had learned, and it's, well, you know, X is how children learn to read, and this is the best way to teach them to read, and that's how they'll be the best readers later. And so here's someone who isn't fitting that mold, and she doesn't have any idea how to cope with it. Like,
yeah,
5 years of teaching experience would probably completely change her attitude on something like that.
I'm sure that, like, 1 week of teaching experience...
She had a pretty rough first day.
Oh, God,
on one hand, you were going, what are you doing? Don't tell kids not to read. Like, that's horrible teaching. And at the same time, by the end of the day, she's just, like, this sobbing mess.
Broken.
You're like, that poor woman is doing the best she can and just has... no information to deal with this. Like, she's not from the town. Because that would be different. If she grew up in the town, then obviously none of that stuff would have happened.
Yeah. I know the kids were kind of, like, patting her, like,
right.
Oh, it's okay.
It's okay, you'll get... Like, none of them had a grudge, even though she was being kind of weird and could have been interpreted as mean, but none of them looked at it that way. They were just like, eh, she's a foreigner, she didn't know any better.
Yeah, whatever.
poor lady, she'll catch on.
But I do like how, you know, Scout knows how to read and write. because if she's bothering Calpurnia in the kitchen, Calpurnia will be like, go, you have to copy this page out of the Bible.
Right.
Write your alphabet, stop bothering me. She's like, Calpurnia, you taught me how to write and it got me in trouble. And she's like, whatever, I don't want you bugging me. She doesn't even care. Like, go write. Leave me alone.
Well, I mean, what are you supposed to... I mean, to some degree, even the teacher is... Even the reaction the teacher did have, to some degree, I could even kind of sympathize with that, just because this is a first grade girl who probably reads and writes better than most of the adults in Macomb County.
Yeah.
Just like, what am I going to do with this kid for the whole year?
Shit. Yeah, like the point Scout makes, like, when she's in third or fourth grade, like, we probably learned everything there was to know except algebra.
It's all it takes, 2 years.
Don't even worry about it.
Are there issues in this book?
We keep... it's mostly fluff. only read it if you're looking for a light weekend, guys.
That's right.
Don't expect to deal with anything.
If you were hoping...
Hoping?
Hmm.
The Hoping.
To Kill a Mockingbird 2. The Hoping. Oh, man. Okay, so...
What were you going
to
say?
If you're hoping to read a book that examines moral issues or issues of racism or feminism, sorry, this isn't your book. This is totally your book. Also, even if none of those things were in there, we would probably draw some feminism out of it anyway.
Well, we like doing that. And we actually already have, bringing up the fact that Scout's a tomboy.
True.
And obviously, maybe not obviously, but in the South in the 1930s, women are expected to be, you know, ladylike. Especially if you're from a better family.
Right.
And Scout's aunt just constantly despairs of her running around in overalls and swearing and refusing to be a lady.
And there's some real conflict there, too. And, Aunt Alexandra, for most of the times you see her as a reader, is not someone that's very likable.
Yeah.
Though she does have her moments, like, occasionally. And one of the things this book does really well, actually, and maybe part of the reason Atticus seems to have such an awesome attitude is because the author seems to have it too, but they'll pull back, like, you'll get to take a step back every once in a while and see the larger context that a character fits into.
Uh-huh.
Going around the time of the trial, they were having some society ladies over, and they were being kind of bitchy. Society ladies,
yeah.
And... Calpurnia and Alexandra and Scout are in the kitchen, and Alexandra, even though she is not really on Atticus's side politically during the trial, she is on his side as a sibling,
mm-hmm.
and more or less says that, and she's like, okay, now let's go back out there and face those bitches, essentially. And Scout's like, oh, okay, and then is actually well-behaved for the rest of the gathering.
She's like, I kind of respect you now.
She's like, oh, okay, so you're still... We're on the same page as far as Atticus goes.
Yeah, and, you know, the world of ladies is not all, like, bitchy society ladies.
Right. Because
you get that from Aunt Alexandra, and you get Miss Maudie, who's just hilarious and caustic. And,
oh, yeah, Miss Maudie is great.
She's definitely not a lady. And so you do get the examples of women in the book who are not, like, just, you know, good Southern ladies.
Right. Well, and those, the women who are not just the good Southern ladies are the ones who get more or less held up as an example of, like, people who are awesome.
Yeah.
Because all the kids love Miss Maudie. Because she's sarcastic and hilarious and...
Well, when your house burns down and the next day you're like, it was too big for me anyway. Yeah,
at least the garden's okay.
Then you're like, kind of awesome.
And makes the best cakes in town.
Yo, that's how I like, communed with her. I mean, she makes cakes for everyone. This woman's awesome. I would go over to her house all the time.
Right. And she'll just, like... She's this, I don't know, she's, I'm thinking, like, probably in her 50s-ish.
Yeah.
So like
Atticus's age-ish.
Yeah, so you have this older woman, and, like, she'll just hang out on the porch for hours with, like, this 9-year-old girl and just kick it.
Yeah.
And, like, they get along great.
I thought so that Sketch just listens to her, like, talk about random
crap. Yeah, that was great. And, I mean, you know, the trial, too. I mean, that's if you want to get into a darker area where feminism applies. Maella being, I mean, you could definitely read that trial scene and be angry with her, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because she is falsely accusing Tom, who is innocent, and who, you know, with his withered left arm and all of her wounds clearly having come from someone left-handed, and accusing him of a crime that he will be convicted of in this area.
Yeah.
I mean, she's more or less sentencing him to death to get out of trouble.
Yeah. Kind of seems like a dick move on the surface.
Yeah, but, I mean, she is a victim, too. I'm not going to excuse that entirely, because he is going to be executed if he's convicted.
But the defense I have for Maella is, you know, she's been abused by her father for years, and when he walks in, I mean, a white man's reaction seeing his daughter kiss a black man in the 1930s might be to immediately conclude that the guy's attacking her, but according to Tom's testimony, the first thing he does is call her a whore and start beating the shit out of her. So, I mean, there's that aspect of it.
Right. I mean, well, she has legitimate motivations there. Like, she's trying to not get hurt or killed herself.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's an important thing to point out that she's not blamed for it or demonized for it in the book.
Right.
You know, the narrative and Scout actually make the point of, like, pointing out that she's in a bad position, and Atticus tells them a couple times, like, when Bobby Will spits in his face, and he says, you know what, if him spitting in my face saved Maella a beating, then I'm glad for him to do it.
Then it was worth it.
I mean, she's just...
Well, she's a victim.
Yeah, she's in a shitty place, and she's not, like, doing this fake rape charge, like, for the lulz.
No, it's definitely not a game, and that's kind of that's more the point that I was trying to get around to, is that she's doing it, and, I mean, really, it happened in the moment, too.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like this thing that built up, it wasn't like one of those, it wasn't like an atonement thing as much.
Oh, maybe. Right. And I would also say that, without her father, like, because, you know, he was the one who pressed the charges, she probably would have just said, let's forget about it, because she knew, like, what was really going on, and her dad was probably like, no, we have to gain some standing in this county, let's press the charges, kind of thing, you know? Yeah.
And so, you know, that leads, and then, you know, the other half of the trial, the really more obvious issue.
Yes, the racism.
The racism.
Which is the focal point of the book.
Yes. Well, it's almost kind of two books. I mean, they do bind together nicely by the end, but the second half of the book is all racism all the time.
All racism, all the time.
Yeah, that could have been our secondary synopsis for this book. All racism, all the time. So, you know, we've been talking about it already, but here's Tom Robinson, black man, accused of raping Maella Yule, a white woman, and even though she is probably about, has as low of standing as is possible to have for a white woman, she's still above a black man.
Yeah, I think in his testimony, they said, like, why did you go into her house? And he said, well, I felt sorry for her.
Yes.
And Scout noted that, like, everyone in the room was like, and then he realized, like, oh, shit, that was a bad thing to say.
Right.
Because how dare you, a black man, feel sorry for a white woman?
Right. That's not allowed.
Even though, you know, he has a loving family and children and saw this miserable woman and obviously felt sorry for her.
Right.
Because...
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, so even though she, you know, her family's basically acknowledged as trash and no one even likes them, she still has this higher standing than he does.
By sheer virtue of being the right color.
Yeah.
Yeah. And kind of the way that the black community responds to the Finch family is interesting. And maybe even before I get into that, the mob scene at the jail,
mm-hmm.
where Tom's there because he's going on trial the next day, the next week, I don't know, soon.
Yeah.
And Atticus is staying there with him because he's pretty sure a lynch mob's going to show up uh-huh. and before the trial can even happen. And he's standing them down, and they're mostly townspeople, too.
Yeah.
Because there's a little, just a hint of that country versus city thing thrown in, too, because they mentioned that the jury are farmers.
Yeah, right.
And that the townspeople maybe would have acquitted him. Maybe. Like, Atticus was willing to speculate that would be possible.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people that just this, because it's a racially charged issue and a sexually charged issue.
Yeah.
They are behaving differently than they usually would. You know, like, what makes a mob happen? Kind of. And it has to be something that people can feel strongly about and then kind of just get carried away.
Makes you irrational.
In the current of it. Yeah, exactly. And because it's a black man who perpetrated a crime against a white woman, they're ready for blood until they get kind of shamed out of it.
Until Scout accidentally talks them down.
Yes, until Scout accidentally talks down the angry
mom. Oh, hey, Mr. Cunningham, how's it going? How's Walter? What's going on? He came over to eat lunch at our house one time. My dad told me you shouldn't have an entail. And then he's like, okay, then go.
They're right, and he's trying to ignore it, finally just takes it in, and he's like, hey, Scout, I'll tell Walter you said hi. And then he's like, come on, boys.
let's get out of here.
We need to go. The mood is broken.
And then, like you were saying, there are a couple instances of the black community interacting with the Finch family. So Calpurnia takes the kids to church one Sunday while their dad's out of town.
And they're all happy to see him there.
Yeah. Oh, hey, how's it going? Like, so happy to see him. And Scout's just kind of, like, taking it for granted. Like, of course. Except one person at the church does come up and try to give him a hard time.
Yeah.
And then Calpurnia is like, says, like, get out of here, you ratty-ass nigger or whatever. Like, says, like, some, like, totally hilarious comment to her. And then the woman's like, buh, like, storms off. And Scout's like, what's going on?
It was like, what is the name of that show? It's going to kill me. There's a newish sketch show, and the two guys who put it on, or who do the show, they're both half black, half white, actually.
Oh.
And they have a bit where this guy's walking down the street, and he's talking on his cell phone to his wife, and he's, you know, just speaking like a college-educated individual, and then he runs into his friend. They're both like, what's up, Evan? Like, all kind of jivey talking, and then as soon as they're done, like, hanging out and bumping fists and, like, heading on their way, like, he picks his phone back up, and he's, like, back to, oh, yeah, so anyway, I was going to go check the stocks on the way home. It's like just this, you know, how Calpurnia kind of does that a little bit, too, because in the Finch household, she's actually one of the few black people in town who is pretty educated.
Yeah.
And she speaks just like all the white people do, which would actually
better than a lot of the white people.
Yeah, exactly. Which would probably, with her Alabama accent, still make us think she sounds like a hick. But then she goes to the church and she talks to their black people using the more black type of language.
Dialect.
That's the word I was looking for. Thank you. God. I'm not doing well with words today. And just kind of like how you fit into
different places,
cultures, depending with what you're doing. Uh-huh. And this sketch that I'm talking about, by the way, is something that was like on TV in 2011, basically commenting on the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, black people still kind of feel that way around...
Like, around white people, you... Well, okay, first of all, I'm white, so what I'm about to say, like, I'm a white person.
Yes, we'll tell you that we're making a couple assumptions with context.
Yeah, but, I mean, I've like, heard people say, you know, well, when I'm in, like, a white group of friends, I feel like I have to talk more properly.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're talking more properly. And then when you get, you know, to the other people, you can, like, relax more. And obviously that's not true of everybody. And obviously there are tons of white people who talk like fucking morons.
Oh, yeah.
So we're not, like, making, like, you know, commentary as a whole on that issue. But that's definitely a thing that's going on with Calpurnia, for sure.
Right. Well, it seems like it'd be difficult to, if you were able to speak in an educated manner, it sure seems like it'd be difficult to not speak that way around Atticus.
Yeah.
Because everything he says is just...
He's so...
Comes across as... Well-spoken. Being so well-spoken, exactly.
There was one more thing I wanted to talk about, the racism issue, and that's what you and I were talking about before we started recording, about how Tom is found guilty, even though the jury's out for, like, 3 hours, which is the longest a jury's ever been out, and they basically spent, like, 3 hours trying to convince one of the Cunninghams to, say he was guilty instead of not guilty.
Right.
And so Tom goes to prison, and Atticus is working on his appeal because he thinks they might have a chance in the Court of Appeals to get him acquitted. And then someone brings him the news that Tom tried to escape prison and got shot and killed.
Yeah, and, you know, something that didn't occur to me reading this book as a 14-year-old, that was the first thing that popped into my head this time around.
Me too, by the way.
Yeah, was, oh, well... They shot him and said he was escaping.
Yeah. That's the first thing I thought, too.
Yeah.
It's never... They never say that in the book. I don't think they even really suggest it. But that was the first thing I just assumed.
Yeah. Well, if anything, they suggest the opposite. Because one person, at least speculates that, well, he saw the justice system fail him once already, so maybe he figured he's better off just trying to run away.
Mm-hmm. And Scout had that little realization of, you know, the fact that he did try to escape was just solidifying black stereotypes in racist people's minds. Like, oh, of course, they always cut and run when times get tough.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another part of what made me think maybe he didn't.
Right.
Because he wasn't, well, I mean...
He seemed like a solid citizen, right?
Yeah, he was just, like, a good person. Who had only ever been, I think, in trouble with the court once because he had to pay a fine... For, like, just hitting a dude or something, but...
Oh, yeah, like...
Some non-issue.
Got hit by a drunk guy, or hit him back, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
So...
Well, let's talk about the significance of the title of the book.
Yeah, okay.
Because that'll tie into our themes.
There you go. Good, that's kind of what I wanted to get to. So, you know, we... mentioned earlier, you don't kill a mockingbird.
TKM.
TKM! And that's because mockingbirds are innocent creatures.
Yes. I actually, as a 14-year-old, I'm not positive I realized this. As an adult with an English major, I was like, this is incredibly obvious. That the mockingbird parallel is commenting on innocence. And
right.
There are multiple characters in the book who are actually, you know, quote-unquote mockingbirds themselves.
Right.
So, like, Bob Ewell attacking Jem and Scout at the end of the book was him trying to kill a mockingbird.
Right.
Or when Hectate the sheriff says, you know, well, we're just going to say he fell on his knife because telling everyone that Boo Radley did it would draw all this attention to him. And that would be, like, Scout even says, that would be kind of like killing a mockingbird.
Right.
Or I think even to a degree, Mael Yule is another representation of a mockingbird that's
yes.
actually...
One that's been damaged already.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think, fairly common in a coming-of-age novel to have this innocence versus experience
yes.
thread running throughout and that theme. But that's one of the really, really significant things in this book because... Jem and Dill and Scout all have to realize, you know, this is the way we thought things worked. Here's this trial and this racism and all this stuff we never really knew existed in society.
Right.
And losing this innocence of, like, people are equal and the world is simple and, like, gaining a better understanding of how people in the South view stuff.
Yeah, and that's a hard lesson sometimes.
Yeah.
Again, Jem just so devastated by the outcome of that trial.
And Dill, Scott has to take Dill out because he's crying so hard.
Right. Dill also very upset by how this is going down. Dill, who we've barely touched on, actually. Yeah. But
oh, well, yeah.
Their quirky, flamboyant buddy.
Who drinks Coke out of a brown paper bag.
And also, let's see, on the... There's a blurb on the cover of the edition of the book that I was reading, and I can't remember what the first half of the of it is, but the second half of it was something like, and the, you know, humanity that unites us all. And I think that's actually one of the big themes of this book as well.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you've all these different types of characters, but, you know, like, you're supposed to have some respect and some regard for all of them and look at them all like they're people. Tom Robinson and his wife, maybe even more so, uh-huh, when they have to go tell her that he's been shot.
Helen.
Yeah, Helen. Or you have Miss Maudie or Mrs. DuBose, who yeah, we haven't talked about.
Yeah, even though Mrs. DuBose is a racist and scares the crap out of the kids because she's yelling at them all the time.
She's just this mean old biddy.
Yeah, I mean, Atticus does point out, you know, she was addicted to morphine. She was trying to kick the habit,
mm-hmm,
which is incredibly hard because morphine is basically heroin.
Yep.
And kicking heroin is
an opiate.
Almost impossible.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, so even though she said hurtful things, like, she was still a really brave, powerful person.
Yeah, I mean, he pretty much says, he says it much nicer than I do, but Atticus basically says, she's the toughest old bitch I ever seen.
And then you get, and I can't remember his name, but the guy who lives with the black community, the white guy.
Yeah.
And he has, like, a black common law wife and kids with her, and he pretends to be a drunk because he wants to let the white people feel better about, like, going, there's something wrong with that guy because he's a drunk, even though he's just drinking Coke.
Right, it's Coca-Cola.
like non-spiked Coca-Cola.
Right.
And he's actually, like, a really decent, awesome guy.
Yeah, he's the one who comforts Dill when they come out of the courthouse, uh-huh, actually. or Boo Radley.
Yeah.
Who
is so cute.
Yeah, like, I kind of wonder a little bit about what the thing is. Like, he's clearly become more and more reclusive over the years, but if he had had, like, his parents were... Okay, so we didn't really touch on religious issues, but his parents were insanely religious, mm-hmm, people. And super strict, and I think he reacted to that. Supposedly there was a stabbing incident.
Yeah, between him, his dad with a pair of scissors.
Yeah, and he never comes out of the house, but it seems like he's trying to communicate with these kids, Dill and Jem and Scout.
Yeah. As they leave some little presents.
Yeah.
He, like, drapes a blanket on Scout at one point without her even noticing.
Yeah, when the house is burning down, yeah, and it was so cold outside, and... and then in the end, of course, is the savior when Bob Yule is attacking the,
yeah,
children.
He kills a man.
Pops out of the house and kills him, yeah.
Which, I mean, is obviously self-defense.
Right.
Because, like, he was trying to kill the kids.
And in the ensuing struggle, Bob Yule got stabbed with his own knife.
No,
it wasn't.
Boo Radley ran out with the kitchen knife.
Oh, he did bring
him.
He did bring the knife.
And the sheriff took Bob Ewell's switchblade off of him and said, oh, I just picked this up from some drunk.
Okay.
That's what he's saying at the end. He was carrying a kitchen knife.
Okay.
When he's trying to make up the new version of events.
I was confused. I thought there was only one knife.
No. Yeah, Bob Ewell had the switchblade. Boo ran out with a kitchen knife to protect the kids and killed him. And then the sheriff took Bob's knife off of him so it looked like he originally had the kitchen knife.
Okay.
Because they're trying to protect Boo's innocence.
Right. Well, I got the same picture out of that. I just thought that he stabbed Bob with his own knife.
Okay.
And it was self-defense, and they were just going to say, well, he fell on it, so they didn't have to go through the trial and getting,
right,
it declared self-defense.
Right, right.
Which is what happened. There was just a second knife.
Yeah.
I
just thought it was so sweet at the end when he goes, will you walk me home?
Yeah.
To Scout. She takes his hand, yeah, and walks him, like, two doors down, because he's so unused to being out in the open.
Right. And then she never sees him again.
Yeah. Fun fact, if I can remember, I think it's Robert Duvall was Boo Radley in the movie, and that was his first movie.
Oh, yeah?
Like, in the credits, it says, introducing, like, big name actor, and then he only appears, like, at the very end and says, like, a line.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Gay?
Well, do you want to move into wrap-up?
Yeah, let's do it.
Strengths and weaknesses.
Well, it's...
pretty strong, right?
It's pretty strong, yeah. I said you can make an argument that it fits the textbook definition of how to write well, how to write good fiction, where everything in there either reveals something about a character or supports the plot.
Yeah, moves the plot along. And that's what I was going to say, is I think some of the stuff at the beginning, people might say, well, you didn't really need, you know, the Mrs. DeBose plot, or you didn't really need the house burning down kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the, like, the little vignettes that aren't, like, necessarily really important, but they do help develop character, and it is all part of the path that leads Scout and Jen, like, to their growing up, so.
Right, and I don't know. Like, if you argued that some of that stuff was unnecessary, I don't know which one I would cut.
Yeah.
There's nothing... I wouldn't want to cut any of it.
I don't really think it's necessary. I mean, it's not a long book.
It's not, yeah.
So it's not like, oh, you know, this is 800 pages long, Great Expectations, so let's cut a couple hundred out.
Right.
And that's, it's pretty concise as it is, so I think it works very well, actually. And as a Southerner, I think Harper Lee did a very good job of capturing that whole attitude.
Yeah, like, I mean, it definitely is something you could point to for, an example of small town Americana.
Uh-huh. So yeah, book's good, obviously still relevant for classrooms today. I think that it's actually really good for people like us who go to school districts that are mostly white. It's like, oh, here's a book about racism that'll help introduce you to ideas you might not have thought about before because you're surrounded by a lot of white people.
Yeah, you just don't think about that stuff because you don't see it.
Yeah, and our parents, like, obviously never said any racist crap to us. So,
when we live in an area when, I mean, even, like, I mean, like, in grade school, maybe you have a black kid in your class, and...
you're just buddies with them.
Yeah, like, it didn't mean anything, but knowing that some of that stuff is out there is good, and probably some of it is even out there in our area to some degree.
Yeah.
It's just, you don't see much of it, because you don't see very many black people.
I mean, I think the first time I read this book, I was in the fifth grade, which I'll talk about in just a second. But the first time I really, really read this book, like, when I understood it.
Right.
It raised all this... I was so pissed off at this injustice. Like, I remember being really ticked.
By at the, like, trial?
Yeah. I was like, what is this bullshit? Like,
right.
This happens? So, I mean, it's kind of even an eye-opener for people in the modern day, I think.
Sure.
So... yeah, the first time I read this book, I was 10. I was just like, oh, I pulled it off the shelf. And I'd never heard the N-word before,
because
I was 10 and our parents never said it ever.
Right.
And I was reading the book, and they're throwing it all around, and Scout asks Atticus, and he doesn't tell her, so I still didn't... I somehow did not put the pieces together, like, who they were calling that.
Right.
And Caleb and I had a babysitter over here, and Mom and Dad were... going out to dinner, and I was reading the book, and I just walked up to the babysitter and said, what does
what
N-word
does,
mean?
What does nigger mean?
Yeah, and she looks at me like, how do you know that word?
Right.
I was like, I'm reading To Kill a Mockingbird, and she was like, well, kind of like, oh. Like, because at first she was like, oh my god.
Yeah.
She's kind of like, oh, and she said, that's a really bad word that talks, you know, like, I don't remember exactly shit, but she said, you shouldn't say it.
Right.
And I said, okay. Caleb, who was, like, eight, heard her and started running around the house screaming at the top of his lungs.
Oh, my God.
And she was like, oh, my. Like,
completely mortified.
Just horrified Mom and Dad were going to come home and, like, think that she'd been, like...
like, she was a horrible racist. Oh, man.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. That was one of my good memories about
Caleb playing the scout role.
Yeah, exactly. I'm Jem, Caleb's scout, so pretty awesome.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, anywho, what are you reading right now, Ben?
I am reading The Cider House Rules by John Irving.
And... which I can't believe, by the way, is written by John Irving.
And also reading Small Favor, which is, of course, the most recent book in the Dresden Files. And it's been a couple weeks, so I probably have read a couple others in the interim as well. But you don't need to know what they're called, I guess.
Yeah, I just finished a book called No, Not Why by Hannah Johnson. It's actually, like, an independently published thing, Kindle version only available. But I saw it randomly recommended online and went, yeah, I'm playing fast and fancy with my money right now, bought it anyway. I actually really liked it. And I just started yesterday reading a book that sounds quite girly called The Princess Academy, written by Shannon Hale, which I gather starts out girly but ends up being a comment on economics and education. So we'll see what happens there.
All right.
So if you want to get in touch with us?
Yeah. Oh, well, we skipped our questions.
Oh, it's a pretty good question, actually.
And my question was, when Scout is writing this as an adult, is she married to Dill?
Because they're totally engaged.
It's like 7 and 8 year olds.
Yeah. I did say, if Dill's based on Truman Capote, maybe he's gay when he grows up. We don't really know. Also, does Jem ever play college football? Big important question.
Football craze.
But yeah, if you ever want to get in touch with us, you can find us online at www.novelideaspodcast.com.
You can also send us an email if anybody does that anymore. novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can find us on Twitter at novelideaspod.
Occasionally updated.
Yes.
Sometimes things actually get tweeted there. We're also on iTunes. If you are listening to us through iTunes, then please leave a comment, leave a rating. Help them notice that we exist.
Yeah. We appreciate it. And thanks to everyone for listening and commenting and making us feel like someone actually listens to this.
Makes me feel good about myself. Validation.
I'm not the only one listening to
it. And so, yeah, I guess you can join us next week when we will be reading The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman.
Yeah, first book in the His Dark Materials trilogy. Had a crappy Hollywood movie made off of it a couple years ago. But it's a YA fantasy book.
Yep. And it's, actually, it's really interesting.
Yes.
I think everyone should read it. Anyone who likes universe building should definitely read it.
Ben and I have already read it, but we're rereading it, and we'll go ahead and throw the plug out that you should definitely read that book.
Yeah.
It's great.
So do that for next week.
The Golden Compass.
The Golden Compass.
TGC.
TGC! Yeah. Not gonna happen. So that's it, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.